Hey, Unchained listeners. As you know, it's hard keeping up with the fast-paced world of crypto, so we've got just the thing for you. Subscribe to our free Unchained Daily newsletter at unchainedcrypto.substack.com. You'll get the latest crypto news and original articles from our reporters, as well as summaries of other happenings in bullet points, plus our meme of the day, all curated and written by our amazing team. It's still your no-hype resource for all things crypto, just in newsletter form. Sign up at unchainedcrypto.substack.com. Again, the URL is unchainedcrypto.substack.com. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Unchained, your no-hype resource for all things crypto. I'm your host, Laura Shin, a journalist with over two decades of experience. I started covering crypto 5 years ago, and as a senior editor at Forbes, was the first mainstream media reporter to cover cryptocurrency full-time. Subscribe to Unchained on YouTube, where you can watch the videos of me and my guests. Go to youtube.com/c/unchainedpodcast and subscribe today. Crypto.com is waiving the 3.5% credit card fee for all crypto purchases until the end of September. Download the Crypto.com app today. This is the fourth installment in the Why Bitcoin Now series, which takes a closer look at Bitcoin in the context of larger macroeconomic forces, such as the pandemic and geopolitical moves happening in crypto. My guests for today are Adam Back, the inventor of Hashcash and the co-founder and CEO of Blockstream, and David Shaum, the inventor of eCash and the co-founder and CEO of Elixir. Welcome, Adam and David.
Hey, it's great to be here, or nice to see you.
Yeah, likewise. Good to be here.
So just a quick note before we begin, I've been a little bit under the weather. I've managed to to gather the fortitude to do this episode. Hopefully it will all turn out fine, but I just wanted people to know that's what was happening while I was trying to prepare for this. All right, so let's start with the first question. How did you both become enamored with the idea of digital currency at a time when that was something that wasn't even really on the radar of anybody in the world and the internet wasn't even really a big thing? And why don't we start with you, David?
Well, sure. In 1977, in the spring, I moved to Berkeley to start my PhD in computer science. And I was transferring. Actually, I had a Regents four-year graduate fellowship at UCLA, but I decided that Berkeley was more my kind of place. So I moved to Berkeley. And I, you know, really focused on privacy and the trying to foresee how the digital world would play out. And I realized that privacy was a key ingredient in that. And I started developing, you know, a few technologies to see where this would all go. And the first one I started with was actually voting. And which more or less immediately led to what's called mixed networks today. And that's something I published in 79 as my master's thesis and then appeared in CACM in 82, I think, but it's pretty well referenced work. And many people have implemented this over the years. It was put it in the public domain. And it's the only real way that's practical at all to create what's we call a large anonymity set, which is the figure of merit in any kind of privacy system, right? It's like, how many people are you actually anonymous among, assuming that the bad guys can see everything that everyone sends to everyone else? That's the threat model, you know, and we learned from Snowden now that that's the real threat model. That was kind of where I started. I thought, yeah, this is really important. If the government can see who talks to who and when, then you don't really have a basis for being a participant in a democracy. This could be a kind of a chilling thing. And so then the next step, to come to your question about money, was, well, then I thought, well, great. So I can participate in this upcoming internet thing or this, you know, the future digital world. We didn't know exactly how it was going to play out in the late 70s. But I'll need some way to pay things and be paid to do things. And if you know, that payment system allowed the linking of who's paying who to be recognized, you know, by people listening in on the network, then it would undo all of the what we call traffic analysis protection, now called metadata shredding, the hiding of who talks to who in the messaging system would be obviated, would be undone by learning who pays who, because then you'd know anyway. So I thought, well, we need a payment technology that will work in this privacy protected metadata shredding sphere. And so that's when I, in the early 80s, I invented eCash, which was a privacy protecting digital bearer instrument. And that's something that I don't think people have really recognized. In some sense, you could call it Bitcoin Zero, it has certain advantages over Bitcoin in that, of course, there's very strong privacy that you couldn't break even with unlimited computing power. And then it also had the property that when you had this money, no one could take it away from you. So that, you know, nowadays you could take, you could change things on the chain if you really want to. Sometimes it happens, but with eCash, there'd be no way to take money away from you because you would have these digital signatures on serial numbers that you chose at random, and no one would see them. Even if they had quantum computers or unlimited computing power, they couldn't figure out which serial numbers you chose at random and have the signatures on. So you would be protected in the holding of your money. So it was a digital bearer instrument that, you know, no one had ever thought of anything like that. And
yeah,
and that was a really big deal. So that's how I came to it.
Okay. Yeah. We'll dive a little bit more into eCash in a moment. Adam, what about you? How did you get into digital currency so early on before anything like Bitcoin was on the scene?
So I started a PhD in 1991. And I guess the year before that, I had a friend who's doing a master's degree. And this is at University of Exeter. We had a distributed systems group with some parallel hardware. So, you know, lots of processors, high-speed interconnects. And it's a kind of interesting challenge to program those things. And that was the topic of my PhD, actually, initially, was more about distributed systems. So I came to know about Byzantine generals problem and things like that before other people who maybe heard about that topic first in the Bitcoin or cryptocurrency context. So in any case, my friend there was trying to accelerate the RSA encryption algorithm on these parallel hardware because at the time, CPUs were a lot slower than they are now. And to encrypt messages was somewhat slow on a general desktop processor and that kind of thing. So I got got to know the technology before the kind of, you know, the very interesting balance of power change of being able to have end-to-end secure messaging that governments couldn't encrypt and so on. So it wasn't long after that PGP came out, and PGP had that very interesting property. I think the internet itself brought a lot of kind of freedoms and more direct participation, for example, in media and blogging and conversations. It's less hierarchical. And there was initially some government friction and adapting to the concept that, you know, while they could maybe influence a large media organization, it's very difficult to influence millions of independent voices with their own views on things. And, you know, of course, that's progressed a lot since, you know, the 80s and 90s. But from the interest in PGP, I joined the Cypherpunks list, which is basically a group of people interested in technology like that. So internet technology with some kind of privacy benefit or change in the balance of power. So the kind of things that Snowden came to blow the whistle on, people were suspicious of. And these were the kinds of people that were suspicious. You know, is the government really actually recording all this stuff? And there was a whole political battle about the banning of encryption, actually, or the banning of export of encryption from some countries, or, you know, discussion about countries banning encryption software that the national security apparatus couldn't decrypt. And some of those things pop up even decades and decades later. So it's kind of disappointing that that's still ongoing. But I think my view was that we have in laws and regulations established rights, and it's a kind of natural balance in society that for, you know, respect and privacy and personal independence and so forth, that you have various rights, but they become harder to enforce or eroded by the mechanisms of the internet. So those are things, some of the things that David was talking about, that, you know, actually to even hold on to the rights that you naturally assume and expect in the physical world, some of those start to get eroded because ISPs are keeping logs initially for other, you know, for service reasons. But once they're recorded, then people start to ask for access to the logs, you know, different law enforcement and so on. So I got interested in privacy technology and read, you know, spent much of the time when I should have been, you know, working on distributed systems, actually reading all kinds of applied cryptography papers, including some of David Chom's papers, and implemented some of them in cryptographic libraries, and actually implemented an eCash library that implements David's eCash protocol, the online version, not the more complicated cut and choose offline version, and also a related system by Stefan Brands, which is just another variety of that. So I implemented both of those systems in a library. And, you know, there was a great deal of interest in privacy technology, but all of the networks were operated by volunteers. So, you know, the cost of the servers, the cost of the bandwidth was volunteer. And it was a big gap in the technology that there was no way to pay for anything. And as David said, you know, as soon as you whip out your credit card and pay for something, now all the privacy has been undone and gone. So clearly electronic cash was needed. So there's a lot of excitement about David's company, DigiCash, at the time, which was deploying the technology that he talked about some decades after he first published the blind signature paper. You know, people wanted to see that deployed in some way or other, and that was for a time deployed in a kind of demo server. But it was, I think, Bitcoin, which came very much later, struck, you know, approached the problem from a different angle, which is it was more distributed but less private. And the reasons for the distribution or decentralization are sort of censorship resistance, survivability. You know, so it didn't depend for its viability on any group of individuals or companies, right? It would just keep operating as a fabric. So there's not really any prospect of the internet disappearing because there are so many different service providers and operators. And so it is with Bitcoin that there are, you know, so many different companies offering integration services and wallets and doing mining and providing various infrastructure services. So Bitcoin becomes much more of a fabric and so more survivable, but it's not as good from a privacy point of view. So, you know, with my kind of interest in applied cryptography, when I saw Bitcoin and started taking more of an interest in it, it struck me that, you know, now that it was here and it addressed sort of robust survivability, that maybe there would be some way to improve the privacy. And of course, there have been incremental improvements over time, but I proposed something called confidential transactions, which is a way to encrypt the values of so how many coins are being transferred, but still have it be publicly auditable. So it turns out you can do that using zero knowledge proofs. And, you know, the challenge is to make it compact and efficient. So that's been implemented in sort of related systems. So like sidechains to Bitcoin, so kind of modular layer twos to Bitcoin, and some other systems. And there are a variety of privacy technologies in surrounding cryptocurrencies, which are interesting. And I hope that, you know, one day as a technology matures, Bitcoin itself will incorporate more strong privacy, either in a layer one or in a layer two. So it's kind of, it came at it from a privacy technology perspective. I think Bitcoin adds one other dimension, which was not something I was focusing on before. I mean, I think that, you know, in the early to mid 90s onwards, there are a lot of people interested to try and find a way to deploy electronic cash, either, you know, using Chom's protocols or other protocols or independently, and finding difficult, like technically challenging to do that. And so I was part of that kind of group of researchers like Hal Finney and Nick Szabo and other people that were discussing those things. one thing that Bitcoin adds that wasn't, to my mind, the major concern at the time is a digital gold like aspect, right? That it would have also some kind of monetary reform or return to a gold standard, but in a digital format. You know, we were looking at it from the point of view, we need electronic money with strong privacy and bearer properties. But if that would have been denominated in US dollars or, you know, some other stable large country currency, we'd have been very happy and felt that we'd achieved the objective. So Bitcoin adding that is a new dimension, and I think likely helped its popularity and adoption as well.
Yeah, super interesting points, and we'll dive into some of these a bit more later. But one other thing I wanted to ask about those early days was there a sense at that time that it was kind of like an active group of people that were all working on this? Or did it have this feeling more of people that were kind of loosely connected on the internet and then each of you were sort of tinkering on your own? I'm just trying to get a sense of the feeling during those days, whether or not it was something that felt like it was almost imminent, or if it really felt like, well, all these people are trying different things, but, you know, it's probably kind of far off in the future.
Let me I could speak to that, Adam, because I think we're talking about two different time frames here. Totally right. Adam's talking about the 90s. I'm talking about, you know, I invented all this stuff in the late 70s and published it in the early 80s. And I did another thing, which was, you know, really fundamental, that opened up this whole discussion. Adam mentioned the crypto wars without calling them that, but that, you know, governments were in this mode of, you know, saying that you couldn't export cryptographic software, or that you couldn't. In fact, they were putting secrecy orders on researchers in the United States. People I knew independently created ideas, and the government would come to them, you can't talk about that. It's a national security, you know, they're going to put you in prison if you talked about it.
Well, Adam, I mean, you have your famous T-shirt, the RSA T-shirt. Can you talk about that for a second? Because that
it's related to what David just mentioned. Yeah. So, well, I was living in the UK at the time, and so various countries had different export controls and regulations, but the US was the largest exporter of software. You know, the nexus of a lot of internet software development, and so the fact that it's had this non-expert policy on cryptography was a concern, and it struck me as kind of silly, so I set about making a very small program that would nominally be unexportable, and it's like three lines of Perl code or something, so it's very small, and I made a t-shirt and sold some t-shirts, and there are people did other things with it, you know, like got a tattoo or, you know, put it as a signature line on the email and so on. So, and I think there was a law professor who, there was a procedure where you could ask if your software was exportable. So there was a law professor who was trying to fight this export regulation through the US courts. And he asked for approval to export this, you know, three lines of Perl, and they said he couldn't. And it's also very anachronous because there's the very strong US free speech, and it's particularly applies to written, you know, to books. You shouldn't, you know, ban books and things like that. And so there were people that, you know, put the PGP source code in books and freely exported them, but to do it electronically would have been illegal or something. So it struck me as kind of sort of silly, but at the same time serious. You know, it was hampering business, and it was meaning that de facto a lot of software wasn't as secure as it could have been. So it was a way to sort of put some political commentary on it. Look, you know, here's the de minimis thing that they would apparently consider to be unexportable. So anyway, sorry, continue with your line of thought there, David.
Well, but just to make clear for people, like, you printed it on a t-shirt, and then so if people flew internationally with that t-shirt on, then they were breaking this law. Is that the case?
I don't know. I mean, if you can export a book, can you export a t-shirt? And it's a bit of a gray area, I guess. But at least it people thought it was an amusing kind of way to protest something that they were quite unhappy about. It was a serious thing, you know, because it was impeding internet commerce, basically, because people didn't feel they could trust encryption, and it was also pushing jobs away from the US. You know, now there were people in Europe writing cryptographic libraries because their US counterparts wouldn't be able to export them, or, you know, international companies setting up offices in Europe to do applied cryptography implementations and things. So it was quite the inconvenience, and it eventually got overturned, but not before there were, you know, test cases and a lot of drama. So the crypto wars, as David called it, yeah, that was a real thing in the 90s.
And so, David, yeah, we interrupted your line of thought. What were you going
to... Oh, well, I'd like to... Let me just turn the big old heavy TV camera back to, you know, when this all was really in play. So as I was saying, a number of my colleagues and friends had secrecy order placed on them by the United States government, which made it a federal crime to reveal what they were researching, even though they weren't drawing in any classified sources. So that's a doctrine that's sometimes referred to as born classified, which we have as an official policy in the United States when it relates to nuclear weapons technology. That makes a certain amount of sense to me, I guess. But, you know, to apply that to cryptography seemed a bit out of range. And so so I was a graduate student at Berkeley thinking about, you know, liberty in the digital world and what it would be like, because, you know, it's a lot more kind of bistable, you know, because if everything's digital, you could spy on everything pretty easily. Or I developed these technologies that would allow you to protect your privacy. So it could go sort of one of the two ways, but all the privacy technology was based on encryption and special kinds of encryption that I developed, you know, and so I really pioneered a lot of that stuff. And I think that's what inspired the cypherpunk movement. I mean, that's what everyone says. But the other thing that I think really is very significant is that this all could have gone a very different way, because the National Security Agency, which is our main cryptographic authority in the United States, you know, for protecting secrets and breaking codes, they got a new director. And this fellow came in and he started writing letters to all the scientific associations, like that, you know, the ACM and the IEEE, which are the main ones for computer technology, telling them that they should not have conferences or even sessions at conferences that covered cryptography, because this was, you know, an illegal export, and that they would, you know, he was going to throw the full force of the U.S. government at them, and you know, the unbelievable penalties would accrue to them because this was totally illegal. And with my perspective at how important all this encryption would be to deciding which way the world would go, and, you know, being a relatively, I don't know, Berkeley young guy caught up in the whole atmosphere there and everything, I thought there's only one thing to do, and that is to organize a conference on cryptography, but to do it secretly, not to use the phone. So I did it all by in-person conversations and I mailed out invitations to a bunch of, you know, basically a guy named Len Edelman was a researcher from the RSA he had a list of, we got a printout in those days, you know, and me and my girlfriend sat in the apartment, you know, and we cut those out and glued them onto these envelopes, you know, and we mailed these things out in the paper mail. And so there was a conference, and most people interested in the field came to it. And it was in Santa Barbara. I stood up there on the stage and thanked everyone for showing up. And I announced that if they, you know, since they paid $100 or whatever it was, $80 to for the registration fee, that now that was a membership fee in a new international association for cryptologic research. International scientific associations are protected by the United Nations. And so, you know, there was a bunch of people in the front row, who registered for the conference as private individuals, not affiliated with any institution, but they all happened to live in Laurel, Maryland, which, if you know anything about the NSA, that's where they, they are. So, so all when I said this, they just, you know, these people all turned green. That was it. It was over. I said, okay, we're having our next event. It'll be in Udine, Italy. And here's Henry Becker. He's going to be the chairman of that. That'll be in the spring. And, you know, it was over. So, the government tried to make cryptography born classified, and they threatened these big organizations, and that scared them because those bureaucrats didn't have a lot, of skin in the game. But I felt it was just too important. So I risked spending the rest of my life in jail to set cryptography free, which I did. And I'm very proud of it. And at that conference, I published the eCash paper. And that conference, that association, by the way, is very robust and exists to this day. It is the main, probably the only real organization in the field of cryptography. It publishes a journal through Springer Verlag. All of its proceedings are published. It has three conferences every year in different parts of the world, plus half a dozen workshops. So it's the international association for cryptologic research, it's called, and it has enough money in the bank, to weather the pandemic. Even if it has to pay for conferences for like a year or two, if no one comes, it can afford that. So we resisted like joining these other scientific associations. So it's maintained a very independent and robust position, and done a great deal to facilitate and build up the scientific community in the field. So this was a pivotal thing.
It's so fascinating. I love that story. So in a moment, we're going to talk more about eCash as well as Hashcash. But first, a quick word from the sponsors who make this show possible.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
How much in fees are you paying for your crypto purchases? Crypto.com is waiving the 3.5% credit card fee for all crypto purchases, which means you can buy crypto with a 0% fee. Apart from your crypto purchases, you can also get a great deal on food and grocery shopping too. Get up to 10% back on Uber Eats, McDonald's, Domino's Pizza, Walmart, and many more when you pay with your MCO Visa card. No card? On the Crypto.com app, buy gift cards and get up to 20% back from merchants like Whole Foods, Safeway, Burger King, Papa John's, and Domino's. Download the Crypto.com app today and enjoy these offers till the end of September.
Back to my conversation with David Shaum and Adam Back. So David, you did allude to this briefly earlier. You created the eCash system, which had as its currency Cyberbucks. How did eCash work? And you can also explain DigiCash.
Okay, well, that's a lot. It's a kind of a lot of stuff. But if you go to chaum.com, scroll down, there's projects, and one of them is the eCash project. And you can see there's a whole DigiCash museum there. And so you can see all about the history of it and pictures of the people and all this stuff. And you can see, interestingly, the banners of the original Cyberbucks accepting shops on the internet. And so there's a whole bunch of them.
Do you want to list some of those for people?
I don't really remember them off the top of my head, but you go there because you can click, if you hover over them, you know, if you're on a laptop, then you can, it'll show the name. And if you click through, you can see, like, from the Wayback Machine, what their homepage looked like. So you can see all your people selling interesting stuff. So the deal was, if you put up a shop and accepted eCash, I would give you 100 Cyberbucks. And there was, we just said, well, we're going to have a million. It was limited. So the idea of a limited issue was something that a lot of people had talked to me about, you know, because a lot of people feel that's very important to do. So we did that it was a pretty successful thing. But I think Adam will recall this back in those days, you know, it wasn't that easy to install the client software and get it to work. And everyone had different versions of different operating systems. And computers were very slow for processing the, you know, all this. And, you know, we were using modems and all that back in those days. It was not easy. It wasn't easy for us to make it a seamless, experience on your smartphone or something. It was really something you had to want to do. So it was kind of hard to compete with credit cards and all that when, you know, as the internet just, you know, accelerated. But what we did, license and build for different banks, also their own system. So the largest bank in Europe at that time was Deutsche Bank. And I went over there and I talked to their board and they were all excited about it and they decided to back us. And, you know, people say DigiCash failed. Well, it's not really true. It was taken down because they were willing to invest, you know, quite a lot more money in it. And the people who got control of the company didn't want that. They wanted to kill it. So it was a sad thing. But Deutsche Bank was a very tough customer. You know, if you can imagine a German bank, you know, the biggest bank in Europe, they had their data center was in an old bunker. It was several stories underground. And they wanted every kind of backup and, you know, recovery and everything. So we had to build all this stuff for them. We satisfied them, but I think it's quite an achievement. So it was a very industrial strength eCash banking system, if you will, that attached to their, you know, what are called current accounts, so their, consumer bank accounts. And there were shops that were accepting. And in those days, of course, it was before the euro, right? It was Deutschmarks. And so you could use Deutsche Bank issued Deutschmarks and buy things online so we made all that for them. It was all Deutsche Bank branded. And then we had Mark Twain Bank in the U.S., which offered U.S. dollars. And so they were an international currency bank. So they had they could do various conversions. So that was great. And then we had Advance Bank in Australia, which I think was like the number two or three bank at that time. Now it's been merged in. They were issuing it in Australian dollars, and we had bunches of people wanting to use it and starting to use it in various countries. And I mean, I think my congressional testimony in the U.S. is, you know, maybe noteworthy, but I also spoke to a bunch of other governments and visited many central banks around the world. And, you know, I told people at that time, what I really told them was, you know, if your country would take the initiative and issue its money in eCash, you could be the electronic commerce leader of the world. This would be a tremendous economic opportunity for your country. And that's what I was pitching when I had that chance to speak to those, because I was invited to a lot of central banks and, you know, Visa International and Citibank and all these. I was sitting there in the boardrooms and meeting the executives. They'd come to visit me and, you know, all this stuff. So, I mean, there was a lot of interest in what we were doing. I have boxes of press clippings from those days, because when I announced I did the first eCash payment, the first World Wide Web conference from CERN to Amsterdam. And that's I wrote a little press release and this guy sent it out from the company, and it was the New York Times picked it up and Wall Street. It was all over the global media in about 48 hours. And there was so much interest in the idea that a number itself could be worth money, you know, that I was interviewed in all kinds of languages. I don't even know what languages. I have a whole archive of videotapes, those big old videotapes of TV shows where I was interviewed, and there was so much interest in it.
Yeah, and let's just look under the hood and talk a little bit about eCash. So I believe that blind signatures were one of the breakthroughs.
Yes.
So can you just explain that?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there are many kinds of digital signatures. Digital signature is a pretty general term these days in its usage, but we have one type is blind signatures, and I invented them especially for payments and eCash. Now, actually, I was hoping that they would be used in a whole range of other applications to do with what I call credential mechanisms. And I wrote this paper that appeared in, it was mentioned on the cover of Scientific American. It was also on the cover of the best journal of computer science, CACM, at that time. You can see it on my website. There's another one of the little project things there at charm.com. But, I created a concept for how you could use the mixing to have perfect privacy in who you talk to, and eCash to make your payments, and then the blind signatures could be used to basically prove things about you without revealing who you are. And so, classic, say, if a kid's at a bar and they want to, or somewhere they want to get in, they want to say to prove that they have they're old enough, or they have a driving license, or they're from a different state or whatever, but they don't want to give their address and all this other stuff. Well, that's what you could do with a credential mechanism. You could prove exactly that you qualified according to whatever, to one way, but you wouldn't have to reveal which way that was. You would just reveal the exact one bit that you were qualified. You'd give a signature that would prove that irrefutably. And that was, so that I found a way that basically turned the databases that companies would have about you inside out, so that now you maintained your own information about yourself. And whenever they would normally ask their own database a query, they would have to ask you, and you would prove the answer was correct. You give the answer and prove it was correct if you wanted to answer it. So that was a whole comprehensive thing. So blind signatures went a little bit beyond. I was hoping that eCash would be like a Trojan horse. People would start using it for payments, and they'd start to say, "Hey, wait a minute! I don't have to reveal my identity to make payments. That's pretty. But if I want to, I can prove that shop got my money. So that's pretty cool. Maybe I could use that to check out library books, or, maybe for these other things." And then the credential mechanism would kind of grow organically. And that's why I went to a lot of effort to publish it in these mainstream publications, try to really distill it and work with artists to, get the concepts across and all that. But so the idea of a blind signature is very, very simple. In those days, we had carbon paper. I don't know if people these days know what carbon paper is.
I know what it is.
Yeah, we have carbonless carbon paper, I guess. You know about that. It copies through. So basically, the easy way to understand eCash, that it's very close to the reality of it, the blind signature, is that, let's just say, I take a piece of paper and I write a random serial number on it that only I know, and I put it in an envelope with some carbon paper inside, or carbonless lining or whatever. I give it to my bank and they say, "Here, it's me, take the money out of my checking account and validate this with your special worth $1 stamp," where it's like a signature that they can make. But on the outside of the envelope, they return the envelope to me. Then I can remove the envelope. Now I have my own random serial number with the carbon image of their unforgeable worth a dollar stamp on it. So now I have this dollar, but no one knows the serial number. And so I'm sure I have the money. And so when I go and no one can take it away from me. They can't, screw with my account or anything. So then I take it to a shop and they say, "That looks nice, but we got to check that you haven't spent that serial number before." So they check with the bank. That's the so-called, what I call the double spending problem in those days, and you hear a lot about it these days, right? And so the bank would then say, "Oh yeah, that's our signature, but we haven't accepted that number before, and so we will honor this and put the money on the shop's account. But of course, we have no idea who the payer is." However, the user is very well protected. So I didn't mention this, but that serial number, it's actually the result of applying a hash function. So if the bank says, "Oh, we already saw that number, it's not valid," then then the shop would say, oh, that's interesting. Can you please show me the number that when you hash it gives you that serial number? And of course, they wouldn't be able to do it. So only once they sign and say, okay, we'll accept it, then I give that hash pre-image, and then they can, then they know. And then, and so that's, it's totally secured in that way. But it's, there's a, so, the, but the privacy is, let's say, asymmetric. And I was very happy with this. And in those days, it really worked well. You know, we had, there's something called the Bank for International Settlements, which is the central banker's, central bank, you know, there, I visited and then I spoke there, you know, it's a whole thing. And they promulgated, they set up, they have a publication in those days called, you know, Definition of Criminal Use of Payments. And they listed them and they were, you know, very strident about it all. And it was basically extortion, black markets, and bribery. And so it turns out in any of those scenarios, as the, if you used e-cash instead of a suitcase full of $20 bills, right? But if you used e-cash, then no criminals would accept it, because since you knew the serial number that you created, you could always kind of tell the bank or the government or something, look out, these guys are going to be spending that, or, you know, so no blackmailer would take payment by check, or, you know, no black market's going to accept Fedwire or, you know, these things. So it was a way to protect the privacy of the individual. And we say that unconditionally, because the blinding and the blind signature is not just cryptography. It's what we call information theoretic statistical security. With unlimited computing power, quantum computers, whatever, you cannot learn anything about what's blinded in there. It's unconditionally protects your, as a consumer, your privacy was, and the protection of your money that you held was perfect. But on the other hand, it wasn't really a suitable currency for, you know, paying bribes to politicians and things like that. So I felt it was a really superior form of money. And in fact, if we could get rid of paper money and switch to this, we could get rid of a lot of corruption and problems, which are, you know, pretty big deal.
Let's also briefly just go over what happened with DigiCash. You did talk about that a little bit. You know, it had offers of investment from places like ING Investment. There was even a plan, I think, for ING Barings and Goldman Sachs to bring DigiCash to the stock market. And Bill Gates expressed interest in integrating it with Windows 95. Netscape expressed interest. Visa wanted to invest $40 million. And none of these potential deals happened. And in subsequent reporting, I guess some sources say that you wanted too much control and employees also felt you were too paranoid or greedy or stubborn. And that's why these deals fell through.
Well, I'm doing this to make the world a better place. And that's why I put my life on the line. And that's what I've been working on all along. And, you know, I think it's really true that the powers that be wanted to kind of, you know, stop this from being what it could have been. And I really,
but when you say that, do you mean Microsoft and Visa and Netscape, or what do you mean by with the powers that be? Because they were interested in, you know, using this and integrating it with their businesses or investing in it.
Well, I mean, what about like policymakers, regulators, things like that? I presume,
but they were the ones who stopped these deals, were they?
Well, I think it's a, you know, one thing I'd like to say is that it's a testament to the significance of the ideas that I developed, and that there was so much interest. And we had very serious conversations with a number of these organizations. It's true. You know, we were represented by investment banks and, you know, and so forth and so on. But if there was ever a scenario in which I felt that the potential of this was going to be taken forward and used to really plant that seed of privacy that I'd hoped for, I'd that was the last thing in the world I'd want to do would be to stop that. So, when you start to really see we're invited into the corridors of massive power, it's quite an eye-opening experience. And, I was at the, invited to, I spoke at a conference of central banks in Milan and in Rome, and they told me that, you know, I mean, it was the airport was clogged up. We said it was like with their private planes. I mean, they closed off avenues, and we walked across a bunch of streets. The police had blocked it all off. We walked right into the Vatican. You know, it was only for us. I mean, they said no non-central banker had ever been to, even allowed to attend any of their meetings. And I had me speak there. I mean, people recognized the significance of what this was, but I'm not sure that anyone was really interested in the disruptive power of it. And it's not like I had a monopoly on this. As Adam mentioned, there were other kinds of blindable signatures that were contorted in a way that they didn't really fall under our control. So I think that, I mean, this is, you know, I don't want to get too broad a perspective to answer your specific question, but what I would say is that just a little bit more generally, you know, if we want cryptography to rise to its potential to make the world a better place for people, then probably we need to do that in a way that is works in a more comprehensive manner and is not more or less a guerrilla action on the side. And that's kind of what I've been really trying to do. And that puts the burden on us to figure out how you could really use this in a way that, you know, would address legitimate issues of society and at the same time, you know, liberate people and human potential. You know, this is the thing that will take civilization to the next level.
Yeah, it's interesting because that description of a guerrilla action on the side is almost a description of Bitcoin. But anyway,
not at all. I wouldn't say that. No. I'm a huge fan of Bitcoin. I think Bitcoin changed the whole landscape. But, yeah, I would say eCash is Bitcoin zero. Bitcoin one is Bitcoin, made a lot of people rich, no question. And Bitcoin two, that's coming. You know, and maybe it needs to be a little more hard to take down and a little bit real privacy and maybe integrated with some other features.
Yeah. So just to give people a sense of the timeline. So you left DigiCash in 1996. DigiCash went bankrupt in 1998. And meanwhile, right in the middle there in 1997, Adam sent an email to the Cypherpunk mailing list about Hashcash. So, David, do you want to dispute what I just said there?
I'm sorry. Laura,
it was timeline, right?
Such a pleasure speaking with you, but I'm not sure. I feel like I'm being cross-examined. A lot of what you said has been said. None of it's exactly accurate, and what you said is not exactly accurate. I don't want to be put in a position to criticize any of this, but I mean...
If I don't have the facts...
I didn't leave DigiCash in 96.
Oh, you didn't? Okay.
No, in 94. I don't know what you're referring to. I mean, the Hashcash was just something that Adam developed, as you know, to protect against spam by using computational cost. And this was something that was already, you know, remember I mentioned the cryptography conferences that I created? So years before Adam's mention of that, it was already, you know, published by Dwork and Noor at the conference.
Well,
you know,
proof of work
right. For preventing spam. So yeah, it was already, you know, what do you mean that Adam wrote a letter to what? I already knew about this years earlier. I was there when Cynthia presented, you know, Moni Noor was my co-author on the offline eCash article.
Right. So, Cynthia Dwork and Moni Noor wrote the proposed proof of work much earlier than Adam wrote the hashcash to the Cypherpunk mailing list.
They presented it at the flagship conference.
Yeah, I believe they presented it in 1993.
Yeah, I was there.
I'm just trying to make a transition for us to talk about Hashcash, that's all, and to show that all of these things were happening right around the same time. That's all. So
that's fine.
But
yeah,
yes.
No, it's really true.
And but I think proof of work.
You know, let me say this. There were a lot of people, you know, a lot of cypherpunks that I invited to visit us and work for us at eCash. It was a very open company. We had a research component. So I had a lot of interaction with people like Zuku, you know, was there for quite a while.
Zuku
and I
Wilcox
worked with him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Try to help him develop his own competing systems while he was there under my employ on my nickel. And, I mean, later Zuko wrote to me, wanted to come to crypto. He had no money. I said, sure, I'll pay for you to come.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I picked him up at the airport or whatever it was, you know, help him out. I mean, you know, then, and right. Nick was there.
Yeah.
And,
Nick Szabo.
Nick Szabo.
Yes.
And, you know, so, it was a so very now, open,
now we're going to talk about Hashcash. So Adam, in 1997, you sent an email to the Cypherpunk mailing list proposing Hashcash. What problem were you trying to solve and how did Hashcash do that?
So I was running Remailer, so a way to send anonymous email and communicate on Usenet discussion groups with anonymity. And as I mentioned earlier, the technology for these things was basically operated by volunteers. So the problem, or one of the problems as an operator of these things, it wasn't that expensive to operate in terms of bandwidth and server resources, but it seemed that some people didn't like free speech or, you know, ability to communicate privately or anonymously, and had taken it upon themselves to spam through these systems. And it wasn't even commercial spam. It was just, you know, random numbers, just trying to be disruptive. And we think, because it was happening to multiple Remailers, there were probably about 30 to 50 of them at various times, that that the people doing this were trying to annoy system administrators who operated Usenet servers. So Usenet's distributed discussion groups, and they use a lot of bandwidth, like a university site or a big ISP. It would use enormous amounts of bandwidth, and so you know, it would start to annoy the system administrators. If people were spamming through the Remailers, the reaction would be maybe to block Remailers or something like that. And I think that was what they were trying to achieve. So it occurred to me that it would be good if there was a way to combat this spam problem. And because it was involving privacy, I had to think about it in a different way, because the usual anti-spam technique the system administrators
use. But Adam, can
use.
I just interrupt you?
Yeah.
I've heard you give the same presentation before, but I'm just wondering, I mean, but Dvorak and Knorr had already published proof of work as an anti-spam mechanism.
Sure.
So this was at the Premier conference. Everyone in the field knew about it. It was published in the Springer lecture notes, and it was in every library, computer science library in the world, practically. It's very widely disseminated.
Yeah.
So why did you have to think so deeply about it?
Well, I wasn't. There's two things here, right? One is.
Oh, okay. But I have one other question for you. I'm sorry. I don't mean to. I know you've made some. Look, I value what you were doing, and I know it's tough to operate a Remailer in those days. Were there also Mixmasters? Were those running in those days? And
yeah,
so in the real deal, that was
right,
the large anonymity? So because you put yourself in a very difficult position knowing the linkings, right? But if you had cooperated with us in a more open system using the mixing technology, you would have been.
There were two generations of Remailers. So Hal Finney wrote the first one, which was just a kind of nested onion, but because it didn't standardize the message sizes, you could say that globally, you know, that wasn't very good for passive traffic analysis, if you like.
I get you. Yeah, I see. I get it.
The second generation was Mixmaster. So I was running, actually it's backwards compatible, but I was running a Mixmaster Remailer for a few years.
Oh, great.
And yeah, and I mean, so in terms of Hashcash, I was not aware of Dvorak's paper until somebody sent me a link to the publication a couple of months after I'd posted the source code for Hashcash.
Oh, wow.
And so some years later, I got around to kind of writing a paper about the experiences of people using Hashcash for various things. And in there, I cited a number of things. Obviously, Dvorak's paper, as I was aware at that point, but also there were some other related things. I think in a way of thinking, the sort of very invention of public key cryptography with Merkle puzzles is a kind of proof of, I mean, it's not exactly proof of work, but it's related.
That's
right?
Very
it's
interesting. Yeah.
So, you know, if you look around, there's a lot of linkages and reinventions in this space, you know, so there have been other things where people have published something. There were, for example, client puzzles, which was another kind of hash-based proof of work by Ari Jules and Brainard, probably also in one of the cryptography papers. And they were not aware of Hashcash, for example, right? So the original Dvorak and Knorr was using asymmetric techniques. there's a lot of reinvention. Of course, I didn't publish it in academic paper, so I just published on a website. So, you know, fair enough, they wouldn't have been aware of it. But just to say that there's a lot of kind of reinvention, and in my experience, the building things in an applied way sometimes brings together new ideas, right? So you can have an idea.
Necessity is the mother of invention, right?
Exactly, right. So that was the kind of general thrust of it. So, and I have, you know, done general publications and things, but more in the distributed system space. So because it was a kind of applied thing for emailers, I just put it on a, you know, like a tech report on a website kind of thing. So anyway.
Go ahead, finish.
Yeah, so I mean, the idea there was to think about it in a way that could preserve privacy. So there are a few features about it that are privacy related. So it adds it has a timestamp, but there's some randomization of the timestamp so that you wouldn't reveal, you know, from a black box. If you're looking at it from the outside, see when the messages are going in, you wouldn't reveal who's likely sender by looking at the timestamp. So it had some features like that. So I mean, just the idea is to, as the same as Dworks in the kind of concept level, which is to create cost. And that's the basic observation, right? The problem with commercial bulk spam is that it costs effectively zero. But I think the advantage of that kind of system is that it doesn't, you know, it's not as attractive because it's not respendable, but it's more scalable. It doesn't require any infrastructure, really. You can just attach it to an email. And actually, much later in 2004, Hal Finney kind of got a bit closer to assembling these different parts together. So he used Hashcash as the proof of work, and he used a CHORM blind signature-based token server, and he assembled it in an IBM tamper-resistant secure processor that he ran. So it kind of had the central point of failure risk, but he introduced mining effectively into the conversation. So he was using Hashcash. So I guess it was a, you can find the website online somewhere. Somebody's archived it. So basically you would do some work. You would send it to this IBM processor that was running in his server, and it would send you back a CHORM token. And because of the kind of trustworthy computing aspect of this card, if you assumed that he wasn't colluding with IBM, which would be a, you know, a big stretch to say that they, you know, they designed this card, they colluded with him, right? So it's a serious piece of hardware that banks buy, and it can provide a kind of signature of execution. So you get, you know, you can verify what code it's running with reasonable security, not as much as the Bitcoin network, because that's, you know, anybody can fully verify, and you don't depend on this kind of, you know, trusted hardware sequence. But nevertheless, it's kind of interesting assemblage of parts. So you could call that kind of Bitcoin 0.5, if you like, in the you know, the Bitcoin zero without a proof of work. he's got proof of work in there, and he's bridging the technologies, right? So it's centralized. It's got the strong privacy because you get in exchange for your work a CHORM token, and the scarcity is there. So it's introducing digital scarcity to you. And I think that Hal Finney and Nick Szabo and a few people were more interested in monetary reforms. So, you know, return to a gold standard or reestablishing something like that. So people were looking at the electronic cash problem from different directions, you know, some from monetary reform perspective, some from a privacy perspective. I was a little bit more on the kind of privacy bearer cash perspective. I would have been okay with, you know, dollars or any reasonably stable currency. But then Bitcoin, you know, if you scroll forward to Bitcoin, it, you know, it loses some of the privacy, but it does plus or minus what Hal Finney's, he called it RPOW, reasonable proof of work. So it basically does that, but in a distributed setting, and the privacy it loses is a side effect. So I think, you know, most people who are involved would like to establish a way to bring that back, but it's more technically challenging to do that, as David would, you know, have a lot of experience in protocol design around. To do that in a way, you know, you end up with bigger zero knowledge proofs and more cryptographic assumptions. So Bitcoin is using actually quite basic cryptographic assumptions. So it doesn't really do anything kind of advanced with zero knowledge proofs and things like that.
And so for both of you, when did you hear about Bitcoin and how, and what were your initial thoughts?
So do you want to go, David?
Well, you know, I'd rather not comment on that exactly. I don't think I've done so publicly. Could we just go back before we answer that often asked question? Because I think it's a very interesting conversation about, you know, these early days. And, you know, one of the things that's colored my thinking, Adam, on this, and I'm curious on your thoughts on this, but was really, you know, in the mid-90s, as I think you've pointed out, the computing power and the network connections and all this, you know, wasn't really up to doing a lot of stuff. And the idea that, you know, you'd have all these servers running all around the world, you know, supporting payments, I think that was somewhat inconceivable to us. We were happy that we could get the client side, you know, to just make a payment in a couple minutes, do an eCash payment, and that we could get the servers to be able to handle their side of it. So instead of having, you know, replicating that server, so to speak, many times. But what we did consider, and I think it's not, I don't believe it's ever been discussed publicly, but several of us in the DigiCash company were working on a more distributed version of eCash that was not, you know, it was somewhere in between. So it was, you can think, it's very easy to imagine distributing eCash in a simple-minded way, right? Where you say, well, we've got, you know, 10 servers now, and if a majority of them agree that it has, you know, they all sign and then they all check the double spending, and if a majority say it's okay, then it's okay. You know, if you were to combine that with, you know, what I published as my dissertation at Berkeley, right, which was the blockchain, everything about blockchain except for the proof of work part, right? Then you know, because that was a majority rule network, right? So that's kind of what we were thinking of as a step to distribute this process, because there wasn't really the resource to just at that point. So that would have been something that would have been achievable to make them somewhat more decentralized, you know, more in the classic BFT kind of model.
Right. I mean, I think
I never heard anyone talk about it. We didn't. That's on us, I guess.
No, yeah. So we, I think Greg Maxwell had a look at doing that as well. So just to kind of make a threshold, you know, like K of N.
Yeah. Yeah.
Signers. And you can see in a straightforward way that would, I mean, that should work. You know, if you can do a single blind signature, you can make K of N inefficiently, maybe more efficiently with some more thought. And I think State Chains, which is another kind of Bitcoin layer 2, is contemplating doing the same thing. I think Greg had some source code but hadn't published it for the kind of threshold blind signature approach. But I think the challenge, and Blockstream actually has a kind of federated blockchain, which is also K of N, so it kind of fits into our thinking for a layer 2 security. But the advantage for Bitcoin itself in the layer 1 is it's a kind of, we published a paper on sidechains and coined the word dynamic membership signature, because you could think of the proof of work as sort of evolving and signing in some way with the work, the most work, the longest chain with the most work, signing off the majority of the work, signing off. And, you know, each signature or each edition of a proof of work, you can have a freshly anonymous participant. So I think Bitcoin stumbled across, I mean, nobody knows who Satoshi is or how he hit upon this idea, you know, whether he came at it from the Byzantine General's fixed membership BFT protocols, or whether he started, you know, straight from anonymous proof of work. But it doesn't have the membership challenge. And something right. with a membership is never permissionless.
That's the big breakthrough of Bitcoin. And thank God that it happened. And it's a fantastic, you know, it's changed the world in a dramatic way. And
let's talk about Bitcoin, because we're well over time and we're running out. So, just how did you learn about Bitcoin? When was that? And what were your initial thoughts?
So I learned about it in, I think it was like August 2008. I got an email from Satoshi Nakamoto with you know, the abstract and asking for the correct citation for Hashcash. And I sent him a couple of other papers to look at, one of them being B-Money. And I looked at it in more detail, actually, when Hal Finney started posting his experiences running it and, you know, understanding how it works. So he posted some longer commentary on, I think, the cryptography mailing list or the Cypherpunks mailing list. You know, I suppose for somebody who's, you know, spent much of his professional career working on applied cryptography, you know, like libraries and privacy-enhanced technologies and things, the thing that will strike you initially until you become accustomed to it is, well, that hasn't got very strong privacy assurances, at least compared to the previous systems, and that the security margin on a double spending is kind of 50-50, right? So you're sort of trusting that the economic majority is honest to some extent, not in all. It depends on the aspects of the system you're protecting. And so, you know, from the normal cryptographic kind of asymmetric crypto, you typically have an enormous benefit as the defender versus the attacker. You know, you're going to do some computation that takes a fraction of a second. The attacker is going to sit there for, you know, thousands of years with using an enormous amount of compute and probably going to fail to decrypt your message. So you're used to this kind of enormous asymmetry. And Bitcoin is like, well, it's, you know, it's the good guys versus the bad guys. It's a fair fight kind of thing, right? So it takes you a while to get over that. But, you know, then you reflect on it. You say, well, you know, on the other hand, it has proposed a novel new solution to the kind of dynamic membership, Byzantine generals, like problem space. And as I mentioned, I was somebody who'd read Leslie Lamport's paper while I was doing my computer science PhD. So something interesting and new in that space. And it's here, it's bootstrapped. You know, after a while it had a value and so forth when there were exchanges, I guess over a year in before there was a price at all, right? So people playing with it to start with. The bootstrap story is kind of interesting. But, you know, the fact that it's deployed and it's decentralized, so there's no really identifiable nexus of, you know, a company or an individual that you would ask to switch off a server or, you know, block something. So I think it's an interesting trade-off, right? Because with a DigiCash and related blind signature-based protocols, you've got a very strong assurance that you can't selectively block transactions. And the only thing that a party operating it could do is shut down, right? They could say, well, I refuse. I mean, I can't block anything selectively, so what do you want me to do? Right? They're all indistinguishable to me, assuming that the sender wants privacy. Whereas Bitcoin is not so much in that vein. It's more that, you know, people are transacting, there's sort of pseudonymity. The coins are kind of pseudonymous. There's no kind of wallet identifier tracking it all. It's kind of imperfect, but there's a de facto fungibility and privacy and an assumption that there's an economic incentive that sooner or later, some miner somewhere will process your transaction, even if the first one chooses not to for policy reasons. And that's like plus or minus hold up. It's a bit of a gray area. You know, there are the companies that specialize in tracking coins that have been stolen. So those ones are kind of a bit gray, but, you know, some of them move once in a while in small numbers. And there are mixes in the network doing kind of coin mixes or coin joins and things like that. So it's an interesting system in which to try and deploy privacy improvements. So, you know, the Lightning Network, which is another layer two, has some mix-like onion routing technology and the layer one coin joins, and Liquid, which is a layer two that my company Blockstream is working on, has confidential transactions. So a different kind of privacy, not sort of linkability privacy, but privacy of the amount of value being transferred.
And David, what about you? Just briefly, we're going to move on to some other questions in a moment.
Like I said, you know, I was pretty familiar with all the different aspects of it. So I don't really comment on that, but what I could say would I'd like to say, I think, is that, I mean, to Adam's point, yeah, I think there are now the technology is out there both on the bad guy side because of the quantum computers and all this possibly percolating, and then you know, some of the new stuff that has been done to speed up mixing by pre-computation very dramatically and to make real quantum secure BFT, you know, those things can come together and create something that has all the real goodness. It's much more definitive, a far higher barrier against being taken down, and even by a national adversary. And the privacy, then you get the full anonymity sets, and you know, you might have also privacy in the messaging, who talks to who. That's a great thing. So I think there's another shoe to drop in this space. But you know, I would never want to be thought of as someone diminishing the significance of Bitcoin. I mean, to me, that is like this game changing, world changing thing, and it's as you know, technologically, it's kind of a complex beast, and I think it's pointing the way to, you know, different things that we could try to improve. And I appreciate the way you're tackling it, Adam. This you know, trying to add things onto it to make it better. And I think that's promising. But one could also, you know, take it all to the next level. And that's something that I think is also, you know, Laura, your viewers should, you know, keep their eyes open for something really dramatically different. You know, I think there's room there to really take it to the next level. So, yeah.
So Bitcoin has gone from a value of nothing, basically, to currently having a market cap of over $200 billion. And meanwhile, we have this pandemic going on, which is causing this economic freeze that has led to governments printing more money. And there's all kinds of other factors going on, like China launching its own digital currency and these other central banks, you know, eyeing the same idea. So when you look at these different forces, where do you think Bitcoin is headed next?
To the stratosphere? As Adam, did you recently say $300,000?
Yeah, I mean, actually, there's been some recent discussion on a different track, which is this stock-to-flow model, which is a kind of just a curve fit on previous year's price movement. But actually, the 300,000 comment was before, which was just, you know, you can't make predictions about these things, but just looking at the use case and the similarity with digital gold. So I was just looking at, well, you know, go look up the metrics. Well, how much gold is there in the world? And people are not exactly sure how much physical gold there is in the world, but they have a rough idea. And, you know, so what's the market cap of gold and divide that by the eventual supply of Bitcoin, and you come out with a number that's like 300 to 500 per thousand per coin. But then that depends on the gold price, which is also a moving target. And of course, with all this pandemic economic uncertainty, gold is typically a kind of macro hedge. So gold price is up, surprise, surprise. But, you know, Bitcoin price is up too. And I have to suppose that while a lot of people have heard about Bitcoin, there's probably, you know, many people who haven't taken the plunge. Bitcoin has differences to gold. You know, you can send it at a distance. You can verify it. It has a lot of sort of more transactional value, a utility value, I guess. So we'll see. I mean, I think it's certainly a very interesting experience to, you know, send some Bitcoin. I think, you know, in our company, we sent Bitcoin transaction, I don't know, like $100,000 or something. It involves multiple people, you know, decrypting and signing different things. And you end up with a small blob of text and you're like, wow, this is, you know, $100,000 of bearer money. It's just an amazing phenomena, right? To contemplate as somebody from a computer science background, that's really a very interesting artifact for the world. So, you know, as technologists, we're very enamored by, you know, the potential of this building block, I think. And what it can do for society to have, you know, kind of dependable electronic money from a monetary reform perspective. Now, of course, it seems that the economic commentators are saying that even though there's been a lot of money printing, it hasn't translated into much price inflation yet. Obviously, there's more money in the system, but the economic downturn has suppressed price inflation. People are not spending money, so the suppliers are having to, you know, coax people to buy things by reducing prices to what they would do in a robust economic situation if you printed this quantity of money. So we don't know if and when that will take effect. I think the experience in Japan has shown that countries can have, you know, low inflation rates for a very long period of time So, you know, some people are looking at the US, for example, as a major economic factor in the world, to say that might be in the future. But I think more recently, the US has even said that it has is considering an economic policy of creating or targeting the creation of price inflation. So I don't know. It's we live in interesting times, I guess, is the thing we can say there.
Yeah. And just for listeners who don't know, I have mentioned this before on the show, but stock to flow is this ratio of the existing supply versus the new supply. So for instance, with Bitcoin, you know, it's relatively small, but actually it's still greater than the ratio for gold. But after the next halving, it will actually drop below that of gold. However, one interesting thing is that somebody took that and applied it to the price of gold over the course of history, and there was not a correlation. So then they felt that that disproved the stock to flow theory. So we will see how this bears out. You know, I'm not sure whether or not that will apply to Bitcoin. But David, what about you? Where do you think this is all headed?
Well, I'm extremely optimistic about the, you know, the future. I mean, all the trends that you mentioned, Laura, seem to indicate that, you know, I mean, if you're afraid to go places in person, you want something you can transact with online. And, you know, there's a ton of crazy stuff going on with governments, these days. So it must all be pointing in a very positive direction, but we're not seeing it right now that dramatically, because, you know, as was said, people aren't really spending that much. So I think this bodes extremely well for the whole space, Bitcoin especially. And it's sad to have to, I mean, I'd rather not think that something that I care about, like Bitcoin, is going to benefit from, you know, all these bad things that are happening to the planet. But in fact, yeah, I think it seems that it will really, this all should be very positive for it. But I'm rooting for the planet though, too. You know,
yes, I all are, isn't that? And for humanity, so we can all go out and hang out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right,
so
well,
we can get ethereal next time. Yeah,
yeah. Okay, well, this has been so fun chatting, and I really enjoyed learning about your early work in digital currencies pre-Bitcoin. That was very fun. Where can people learn more about each of you and your work?
Well, I would like to suggest people also could look at the XX Network. You know, we're live in beta, and we've got a lot of good stuff running, and it's look at the white papers. It's really solid stuff. I'm extremely it's best stuff out there by far. I think I'm very extremely enthusiastic about it, and we've got a lot of good backing. So please, yeah, have a look at that. And but if you want to know about the historical stuff, look at etchom.com and look at the eCash Museum and the different other things, multi-party computation. We didn't get a chance to talk about. That's another interesting vector on all this, like kind of generalizing the smart contracts and the ICR and the history of it. And if you're interested in all that, so there's, it's all up there. And I guess the one aspect that I would like to also draw your attention to is, you know, this kind of cryptographic technology can also be used in elections and voting and online voting and so on. And that is a very much related to, you know, to payments and messaging. And I think this is an area where I'd like to see a lot more. I think there's a lot of potential there. And so I've been working on that for a long time, and you can read about some of the stuff up on my site that I've been doing on that. So we're making great strides in that, actually. There will be some new work coming out very soon. So charm.com and XX Network. XX.network is the URL. Yeah.
All right. And Adam?
So I have a personal webpage on cypherspace.org, cypherspace.org, which has, for example, pictures of the t-shirt that you mentioned and various cryptographic libraries and things I've implemented over the years. And on Twitter, I'm Adam3US, and Blockstream, which is the company I co-founded some years ago now, is blockstream.com. I think, you know, we were talking about the Dwork proof of work in Hashcash. So I think that's been something that's there's been discussions about various times. And so one kind of question I turn my mind to is, well, you know, is there, you know, why are people using Hashcash for the proof of work and not other proofs of work, right? So, you know, there's the client puzzles that Jules and Brainard produced. There's the original proof of work by Dvorak and Eeyore.
Oh, I see. So the Hashcash mechanism itself is the one that's prevailed.
Yes. Well, I think there's a specific reason in hindsight. So at the time I did it, it wasn't used for that purpose. It was just used for one-use stamps. But the result is that you get a compact proof of work because it's fixed size, whereas the Dvorak and Eeyore were like broken asymmetric signatures. So signatures were low-key sizes so that you could brute force them and create forgeries and things like that. So there's three variants. Two of the variants have progress. So you need like a Poisson process for fairness, like a level playing field in crypto mining. The third one, which is based on, in Dvorak and Eeyore, is based on this square roots in large prime fields. And there's an algorithm in that called Turnelli-Shanks, which has some randomness, but it's not clear if that's sufficient to have a level playing field, because there may be other slightly less optimal square root algorithms that the single fastest computer can tend to win. And that would be a problem again. And then the other side effect is that those systems they're not as easy to scale in terms of the difficulty. So with Hashcash, the stamp was, you know, compute a million tries. So, you know, 20 binary digits of zero at the front, but these days it's enormous, right? It's 70, 80 leading zeros. And so if you scale some of those kind of broken signature based schemes, you end up having to increase the prime size or the Fiat-Shamir transform size, and you get an enormous proof. So the proof of work might itself be bigger than the block of transactions you're trying to prove about. Plus the fact that they're not Poisson is like a stumbling block, if you see what I mean. So anyway, this sort of like in hindsight, so it's like a curiosity, right? So, well, you know, given that there were these parallel different variants, and the other one by Jules and Brainard is actually interactive. So it's not, you know, it's a proof with respect to a server. So that's not amenable to, you know, independent verification, let's say, to the audit function. So anyway.
I'm really glad we had a chance to speak about it. Thanks. That's so interesting. Yeah. So I'm glad to hear that the approach that you took is really, really turns out to be the superior one. And congratulations on that. That's excellent. I'm going to mention that going forward. I was unclear. I was looking forward to this chance to, you know, we've met before, but I wanted to ask you about this because I thought it was going to come up.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's, I think it's also, you know, very simple. So simple things win. So when I was designing it, I was thinking about, you know, should I introduce floating point to make it harder to make an ASIC? You know, so already I was thinking about spammers are very determined economically. They'll make ASICs. So should I make it complicated? Should I involve memory? I looked at time memory trade-offs. I was like, you know what? I think simple is better. So if I kept it to, you know, a standard SHA-1 function at the time, so you'd be able to verify it even with a shell script using a SHA-1 function, right? So anyway, simple wins, and it happened to have the Poisson function, which I was actually determinedly trying to eradicate because it was a nuisance for spam purposes, but turned out to be an advantage for distributed fairness or something like that.
I'm not going to even try to pretend to translate all that for my listeners, but hopefully the more technical ones will have understood. And at least now we have an understanding of why your proof of work was perhaps more widely used than the original version. Okay, well, this has been so fun chatting with you both. Thank you both so much for coming on Unchained.
Hey, thank you, Laura. This was great. I really enjoyed it. Thank you again.
Thanks so much for joining us today. To learn more about the history of digital currency and David and Adam, as well as their various inventions, check out the show notes for this episode. Don't forget, you can now watch video recordings of the shows on the Unchained YouTube channel. Go to youtube.com/C/Unchained Podcast and subscribe today. Unchained is produced by me, Laura Shin, with help from Anthony Yoon, Daniel Ness, and the team at CLK Transcription. Thanks for listening.